This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Dave Mistich. Today, we remember a Vietnam veteran who touched the lives of not just West Virginians, but many people around the world.
It was my first 5 minutes off the helicopter, and I kept thinking to myself, I've got 364 more days of this.
We'll remember Dave Evans, a West Virginian and Vietnam veteran who spent his life after the military helping those ravaged by war. That's coming up on this West Virginia Morning. With recent protests against racial injustice and police brutality following the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other black Americans, some groups involved in the protests have become the focus of much attention from the news media. President Donald Trump and Attorney General William Barr have blamed vandalism at protests on Antifa, while a group known as the Boogaloo Boys have drawn attention during anti-lockdown protests and showing up at Black Lives Matter events while carrying weapons. Chris Jones is a Report for America fellow. His beat covers domestic extremism for 100 days in Appalachia. He's here to talk about a story recently published on that website about these two groups. And I use that word groups loosely, as you'll understand in a moment. Thanks for joining me, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, let's start with defining Antifa. I understand that it's not a monolith and there is no hierarchy. Tell us what it is, but more importantly, what it is not. Give us some background on Antifa and what that represents in this moment.
So the term Antifa actually comes from the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, and it was used to describe people who are against the fascist forces of Franco. In the 1980s, it came over to the United States, and it was used by groups of activists who would oppose white nationalists and neo-Nazis and skinheads in cities across America as kind of a catch-all term to define anybody who would come out to oppose these groups. It really became prominent in 2017 after a white nationalist protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a lot of people came out as counter-protesters against that action and organized under the banner of Antifa. It's important to note that it's not a group in any sort of sense, despite what the White House and Attorney General described it as a terror organization. It doesn't actually have an organization, and it's honestly better understood as a type of activism or a type of protest that really only exists in and of itself. So when Antifa does something, Antifa exists, but once they've stopped doing something, it doesn't exist.
Another group many people have heard about in recent weeks is known as the Boogaloo Boys. That represents a very stark and different ideology than what we think of Antifa. Explain to folks what this group represents and what is known about them so far.
So the term Boogaloo began being used about 2 years ago by extremist groups online and in certain anti-government spaces and chat groups to describe what they consider to be an impending second civil war in America. Some of them believe that it's something to be sought and that they should act in order to accelerate it. And others just believe it's an inevitable thing that will happen. The group itself that we now call the Boogaloo Boys or the Boogaloo community really came out of these discussions and the type of memes that they were creating and putting out there. And then a set of aesthetics came out. They're often seen in public wearing Hawaiian shirts while they carry weapons. They have flags that have igloos on them. And a lot of this all came out of the type of rhetoric and jokes and ideologies that more well-known and established right-wing extremist groups like the militia movement or Three Percenters or Oath Keepers have put out into the world. And with the Boogaloo movement, we really see a lot of that repackaged and put out to appeal to a younger audience. They really only existed online until a pro-gun rally in Virginia a few months ago that was protesting red flag laws in that state. Then they began showing up at anti-lockdown protests in Michigan and across the Pacific Northwest. But then after the protests against the murder of George Floyd began in Minneapolis, we began seeing people who were associating themselves or dressing up as Boogaloo Boys showing up at these protests. Sometimes they would claim to be in support of the protests, but more often than not, they show up in opposition to them or what they claim is to be guarding property or statues from destruction. It's important to note that in some ways, like Antifa, they don't exist as an organization. They're really based around these online spaces and these communities that they build and this aesthetic that they've become to be known by.
National news media often does a poor job of making distinctions between these kinds of groups, What do people need to know that they aren't getting from most reporting on these protests and the people that are showing up to them?
So one of the big misconceptions is that Antifa is an organization that is committing violence. A lot of different news outlets and research organizations have really looked into this to try and find evidence. And what they found is that so far there has not been any arrest or act of property destruction or violence against law enforcement that's been deliberately and explicitly tied to Antifa. Obviously, a lot of that is a product of the fact that it does not exist as an organization. On the Boogaloo side, again, it's not an organized entity, but there have been multiple acts of murder as well as attempted terrorist attacks committed by people that have been either self-identified as in the Boogaloo community or have been identified by law enforcement as within the Boogaloo scene. In California, a man who identified himself with the Boogaloo community murdered two law enforcement officials. And in Las Vegas, the FBI arrested three men who identified themselves as Boogaloo boys who were attempting to cause mass violence during a Black Lives Matter protest.
Protests against racial injustice, they're continuing around the country. It's an election year. Tensions are really high in America right now. Given all that, it's probably safe to say that we'll be hearing more about Antifa and the Boogaloo boys based on everything you're saying. But my question is, what can we expect going forward?
So with Antifa, it's likely that we'll continue to hear that name being brought up by the White House and the Department of Justice in connection to violence around anti-police brutality protests. However, it is important to note that so far, none of it has actually been attributed to Antifa. However, Antifa will show up if there are public displays by white nationalist groups and white supremacists. The Boogaloo community itself is going through an identity crisis as it tries to define itself as not racist. However, the distinction is whether it is explicitly anti-government or if it is racist and anti-government. It's also noted that because it is such a contentious political climate, you know, there will likely be more acts of political violence. And historically, right-wing extremism rises during tense political climates. However, this is something that law enforcement on both the state and federal level are monitoring closely, and it's worth noting that most of the attacks by Boogaloo-associated individuals have been prevented before they occurred.
Chris Jones is a Report for America fellow covering domestic extremism for 100 Days in Appalachia. Thanks for joining me to tell us about your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
In the most recent episode of Inside Appalachia, we revisit an episode about Charleston's black community and several chapters in the city's history. Some say urban renewal in the 60s and 70s forced many black residents to leave their neighborhood, which was called the Triangle District. Many residents left the city and the state. Some moved across town to a neighborhood known as the West Side. Reverend Matthew Watts, the senior pastor at the Grace Bible Church of Charleston, persuaded his church to move to the West Side because of the need he saw among the neighborhood's residents. He and his wife moved onto what he said was, at the time, the toughest street on the West Side. He says he wanted to be more creative, more disciplined, more determined, and more resolved to do something about the problems faced by the community. Watts spoke with Aaron Henkin for WYPR's Out of the Blocks podcast.
Well, I'm a native West Virginian, born and raised in the southern West Virginia coal fields in Fayette County, but I've lived here for 40 years, actually. My name is Matthew J. Watts. I'm the senior pastor and teacher of the Grace Bible Church of Charleston. And so when I became the senior pastor of the Grace Bible Church, I persuaded the church for us to move to the west side of Charleston, that the need there was great because of the challenges and the fact that it has the highest concentration of African Americans that live anywhere in the state of West Virginia was another pull for me to come to the West Side. I think what it's up against is a history that is couched in slavery, discrimination, marginalization, exclusion, and exploitation. The West Side was established as five slave plantations, places like Hunt Avenue, where the Hunt were slave owners. Corey Street, a major street downtown, is also part of the West Side, slave owners. Summer Street, slave owners. The Patrick Street Bridge, slave owners, right? And that history basically was totally ignored. No one talked about it. And so it helped us to begin to educate the community how to counter, to offset 155 years of history that's laid down like shellac in layers, right? I walk a lot. That's why I got this, you know, walking suit on, right? I had this heart attack last year. Now I'm serious about my health and so forth. I see the pain of poor people. I see the pain of black people in particular. My wife and I moved in on the street at the time. It was a tough street on the west side of Charleston about 6 years ago. I feel led to do that because I feel like I've got to feel the pain of the people. Their pain got to become my pain. Their problem got to become my problem, because if it is, I'll be more creative, more disciplined, more determined, and more resolved. I'm more courageous to try to do something about it. And so by the time I get to the pulpit on Sunday morning, I know that some of my people experience that pain as well. And so I look out on my congregation and I see them out there. And I know the people whose son is in prison. I know the grandmother lived across the street who's raising her granddaughters because her daughter has her problem. And what I see in my congregation, I see incredible resiliency. We have kids in our church that have been dealt a tough hand. You know, some of them, fathers in prison. Some of their fathers are dead. Some of my kids don't know who their fathers are. But they're going to school every day. And they're trying, right? And they're solid citizens in school. And they have every reason to say, I'm mad at the world, right? And be wreaking havoc within the school system. And we just got the report cards, and we're just so excited because they all did well. Their resolve also motivates me in terms of the human spirit. So you keep trying to do the best you can every day.
That was community activist and pastor at Grace Bible Church in Charleston, Reverend Matthew Watts. That story was produced by WYPR's Aaron Henkin for a podcast called Out of the Blocks, with the help of Emily Hilliard, the director of the Folklife Program of the West Virginia Humanities Council. You can hear more from this series on the latest episode of Inside Appalachia. Find it on our website, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. This weekend brought us the sad news of the passing of a native son of West Virginia, a U.S. Marine Corps Vietnam veteran. Dave Evans of Cabin Creek in Kanawha County spent the last four decades traveling to war-torn countries, fitting the innocent bystanders of war with prosthetic limbs. It was a passion that touched literally thousands of lives around the world, and a lifelong commitment Evans made following the loss of his own legs in an ambush in Vietnam in 1970 when he was just 18 years old. After returning home to West Virginia, he became a state leader and a national player in the anti-war movement. Dave Evans told his story to executive producer Suzanne Higgins in 2016. Here's an excerpt about his time in Vietnam.
When I was 18 years old, I was a squad leader in the United States Marine Corps. I could bring an F-14 Phantom in and drop napalm on a village with no other authorization but mine. No pilot ever asked me, "How old are you, kid?" I would just say, "Give me high explosive, and I need it right now." And they would do it. That's the way that war was ran. That's the way the war was ran. My first day in the field, coming off the helicopter, we made contact and was taking fire from a village, and we leveled the village. I mean, we really did. It was my first 5 minutes off the helicopter, and I kept thinking to myself, I've got 364 more days of this, you know. Once we recovered the bodies, we had three dead North Vietnamese soldiers, two older ladies, and two babies. 4 or 5 year old children were dead. And I remember coming over. I was a radio operator at the time. I was carrying a radio for my lieutenant and looking at these bodies and saying, okay, we killed them to liberate them. And I kept thinking, there's something fundamentally wrong here. You know, we weren't taught in Paris Island to shoot children and old women, but suddenly that was the norm. You know, could we have done something different? We were taking fire. I don't think so. Should we have been there in the first place? Hell no. Anybody that tells me they came back normal, no, it's impossible. It's impossible. You can't cross that bridge. You burn that bridge when you go, and there's no coming back. No coming back.
Dave Evans was one of five Vietnam veterans from West Virginia who shared their life stories in our documentary, Vietnam, West Virginians Remember. You can find the full story of Dave's journey, along with the other veterans on our program, posted at wvpublic.org/VietnamWVE. Dave Evans passed away Saturday, July 3rd. He was 68 years old. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our Appalachia Health News Project is made possible with support from CAMC and Marshall Health. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Caitlin Tan, Jessica Lilly, Kara Lofton, Liz McCormick, Brittany Patterson, Eric Douglas, Corey Nollinger, Emily Allen, and Roxy Todd. I'm your host and producer this morning, Dave Mistich. Thanks for listening.